Can I ask everyone to be quiet? Even people coming in, because since time is elapsing, I think I ought to start, actually, if you don't mind. And please forgive me, the people coming in upstairs. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to talk about America today. Some people asked me after the last lecture whether I'd finished like 5 minutes early in order to have a bit of discussion, so I'll try and do that today, if I can anyway, fit it all in. I mean, since we haven't really started properly, it's only 6 days until the American presidential election. Latest poll showed, or the most reliable poll showed, 48% to each candidate. Who here thinks that George Bush is going to win? Okay, who thinks that Kerry's going to win? Well, that more or less reflects the state of the, I think, of the election, because no one knows who's going to win. Can I ask you a more important question? Who thinks it'll make a big difference to American foreign policy and American domestic policy if Kerry should win? Well, that's quite encouraging, because, I'm a good social democrat. I'm a Kerry supporter, and my view is that it will make a difference. It will make a difference to domestic policy, because the policies the Bush administration basically favored a small elite, and they haven't really created many new jobs in America. I think there will be a switch of policy under Kerry. And I think actually it will make a difference in the international arena, because at least there'll be a fresh start for what I'll be arguing in this lecture the United States needs, which is surely a more multilateral approach to global society. I think it will generally make a difference. And I sort of fear that Bush will win, but very much hope that Kerry will do so, and he's clearly in there with a chance. I mean, I just love all these George Bush jokes. You've probably heard most of them. George Bush and Dick Cheney go into this diner, right? And George Bush sits down at the table with Cheney, and Bush says, the waitress comes up and Bush says, "Hi honey, what about a quickie?" And the waitress goes away all offended, muttering about female emancipation, women's rights and so on. And after she's gone, Cheney leans across to George Bush and says, "George, it's pronounced quiche." Well, it wasn't my joke, but I mean, it's quite a good one. And it's not a very accurate one, because Mr. Bush is a highly astute and skilled politician, so one must certainly recognize that. The bulk of my lecture, however, is not political, and it starts from where I left off last time, which is that in the new global age, which I reckon is only about 30 or so years old, for the reasons I said last time, there is a kind of prevalent crisis of identity upon us. And that crisis of identity, I think, does affect us all as individuals. All of us are now living in a world with this kind of mixture on an individual level of emancipation, the possibility of living a better life, the possibility of living a freer life on an individual level, and a certain crisis of identity. What should I do? Who should I be? How should I act? What kind of life should I forge for myself? And this crisis of identity on an individual level is very much related to the expansion of the global forces that I talked about last time. And it's very much related to the kind of disappearance or dissolution of tradition, custom, and habit in our lives, because this frees us up to live a different life, but it doesn't tell us how to live it. It doesn't tell us what identity to assume. And it's in that gap that you get the sort of emergence of a fierce reassertion of tradition, which wants to tell us how to live, which wants to tell us who to be, which wants to say we can have taken for granted traditional truths in this open world. And the battlefield between cosmopolitanism and a more fundamentalist view of the world, as I suggested last time, is part of the kind of fracturing lines of the global age. But the identity crisis which we have also affects nations. I think it's true you can't find a single nation in the world which isn't experiencing some kind of identity crisis, for the very same reasons. Now, you should remember that the term crisis, as it was originally formulated in the classical world, was not a purely negative thing. A crisis was a critical phase of one's life. A crisis is therefore, in classical terms anyway, always thought to be an opportunity, as well as a problem, as well as a burden. And this is the sense in which I use it here. There is a crisis of national identity in most countries. It's a mixture, again, of the possibility of forging something new, of forging a new role in the world. It's a possibility of breaking away from the past, but it comes along with the sort of burdens of how should we relate to one another? What are the emotional bonds which tie a nation together today? You can see it easily in the United Kingdom. What is the identity of the British? Now we have devolution to Wales. Now we have devolution to Scotland. We have devolution to Northern Ireland. The British and the English, at least to people living in England, as opposed to the other nations, always seem to be unproblematic. People used to use the term British and English as though they were the same, and many people still do, but they're not the same. The Scots never used them, to my knowledge, as though they were the same. You see a kind of re-emergence of English identity with, for those of you who were in the UK during the last Football Cup, European Cup, you know, these English flags, which is a sort of red cross on a white background, suddenly appeared everywhere. But English identity seems to have been claimed by the kind of groups who react against the wider world. There doesn't seem to me anyway to be a kind of cosmopolitan identity which either England or Britain has properly shaped in the contemporary world. Or look at Sweden. In Northern Europe, a few months ago, the Swedes had a referendum on whether they should join the euro. And they decided not to join the euro. But as with all referendums, it was not a referendum just on the euro. It became a referendum on Swedish identity. What does it mean to be Swedish? How should we relate to these wider forces? Will our identity be swamped, be lost, if we become too closely involved with the European Union? What kind of nation should we be? It was on the face of it, an economic referendum about whether it's better to have a single currency or not, but it became an intensely emotional thing which split families, and of course at least one person, Anna Lindh, lost her life as a result of an assassination while just before the actual referendum was taken. And the crisis of identity also is found in the biggest nation, the United States, the dominant nation in the world, and has been the subject of a great deal of academic discussion, especially over the past 3 or 4 years. I'm trying to make this kind of... I was trying to make sort of technology work. Can't. Oh, well. Somebody else can. Anyway, a famous political scientist called Samuel Huntington, that's Huntington, just written a book called Who Are We? About American identity. This is the same Samuel Huntington who coined the phrase the clash of civilizations. And in his book, Who Are We?, Huntington raises the question, what is the identity of the United States today as a nation? Not many people will like his answer because he holds that this identity is under strain because of massive immigration on the part of Hispanics in the southern part of the US, and he envisages the possibility of a segmentation of the United States, a bit like Belgium, between two different linguistic communities. Many critics certainly do not accept that, but he poses these interesting questions. What is the United States? Is it, as some people have said, the universal nation? Some people have said the United States is the universal nation because the United States stands for generalizable ideals, which one could certainly make a case for saying that if they were propagated around the world would benefit. the United States could be said to be a universal nation in the sense in which it incorporates so many ethnicities. The United States is no longer in any sense an insular nation. It's made up of largely of almost completely, well, I suppose you go back far enough, completely of migrants. You have an enormous diversity in the United States. So is it a kind of reflection of world society that, rather than a simple nation? Huntington asks. He thinks no. Second, is the United States, the identity of the United States, essentially formed by the principles of the founding fathers, the Constitution, the ideas that underlay the Constitution? If you're going to have an integrated nation in the United States today, should it still encompass those values? Huntington's answer is basically yes to that question. But you can have a third possibility. As he says, is the United States, the identity of the United States, does it always depend on an other? Can you have national identity which is not formulated in opposition to other identities in the world? Many sociologists actually would say no, you can't. For anyone who knows Linda Colley's book on Britain, Linda Colley was teaching till recently in the LSE. She wrote a famous book called Britons, which is about the origins of British identity. And she says Britain as an identity was forged out of conflict essentially with the French. It was formed diametrically, oppositionally. And obviously the identity of a large component of the United States until 1989 was formed out of opposition to the Soviet Union and the perceived threat of Soviet communism across the world. Maybe one could say it's now forged in conflict with radical Islam. Maybe one could say it's now forged in the differentiation from Europe, because many people are claiming, and I'll be discussing this in the course of this lecture, that the United States is now sharply diverging from Europe, from the core of the nations that compose the European Union. And it's in this kind of opposition that you might seek to find its identity. The idea of a radical sort of split between the United States and Europe has been much discussed in recent years, and especially, I'm sure some people here will be familiar with this justly famous set of writings of a guy called Robert Kagan, who wrote a famous article called The Power and the Weakness, which he later wrote up as a book, Robert Kagan. Just about reading my writing with this sort of new technology. It's all wobbly, isn't it? Well, it's much easier with old technology, in my opinion. Kagan tried to generalize the difference between the United States and Europe. Europe, he says, is militarily weak. The European Union is militarily weak. When a society, or in this case a group of societies, is weak, whenever anyone is weak, they tend to have recourse to persuasion as a means of defining what they do in the world. Since Europe is weak, Europe therefore favors multilateralism, Kagan says. Because if you're weak, you can't coerce other people into following you. You have to persuade them to follow you. You have to negotiate with them. You have to favor what the EU does favor, the emergence of international law, international institutions, transactions between countries, and generally an approach which depends upon negotiation and compromise in order to succeed. The United States, by contrast, is militarily strong. According to Kagan, it's got a conviction of its place in the world, or at least a significant chunk of Americans, the American leadership, have a conviction of America's place in the world. America, therefore, doesn't need to negotiate, doesn't need to support a multilateral regime in the same sense as the EU does, because the strong don't need to do this. And Kagan has these now, you know, so I'm sure most people here will know, his celebrated observations on this, that you remember, I'm sure you're all into personal relationships, you remember John Gray's book about women being from Venus and men from Mars. Well, Kagan says that the Americans are from Mars and the Europeans are from Venus, because Europe is a kind of feminine influence in world society, whereas the United States stands for a masculine one. And he has this equally famous observation that the Americans do the cooking and the Europeans do the washing up. That is to say, the Americans intervene militarily in places and the Europeans come along and help and try to make peace, and that's a kind of division of labor in world society, but it's the basis of a pretty strong critique of Europe. And it's not one to be taken lightly, because Kagan says that in Europe, we're kind of realizing Immanuel Kant's view of eternal peace. You remember Immanuel Kant, the famous German philosopher, thought we could have a world of eternal peace, that we could overcome war. And Kagan says, well, in a certain sense, the EU has achieved this within its own domain. You can't imagine, I mean, you have conflicts in the Balkans, but you can't imagine nations within the European Union any longer invading one another or confronting each other militarily. So there is a kind of perpetual peace in Europe. But this perpetual peace in Europe and the mechanisms it's been achieved, Kagan says, they won't work, or they only work very partly in the rest of the world. Because the rest of the world is still largely Hobbesian. The rest of the world is not a Kantian, idealized perpetual peace. It's a world of power struggle. It's a world of brutality. It's a world of nations that don't want to obey the will of the international community and will use force in order to secure their goals. So the United States, he says, can't be just a self-enclosed corner of the world. It has to operate in a world of power. And in a world of power, military strength is crucial to the goals that a nation seeks to achieve. And there is some substance for the Kagan view. If you look at things like the World Value Survey, which is very interesting, I don't know how many people here know it, but it's a big, big survey of large number of nations through the world in terms of the values that people in those nations accept and their kind of view of the world. And it covers all the industrialized countries as well as others as well. And it does show fairly systematic differences between the United States and the European nations, and indeed the United States and most other industrial countries. For example, the United States is much more religious than the European countries, and also most industrial societies. In the United States, something like 70% of the population claim to go to church regularly. In the United Kingdom, for example, in Britain or in EU more generically, in Britain it's only about 10% of the population who claim to go to church regularly, and this proportion is dropping. In the EU as a whole, it's only something like 18% of the population claim to go to church regularly. So I'll come back to this issue later, but the World Values Survey does seem to show that the United States is a much more religious nation than almost any other industrial country, and much more religious nation, actually, than most other countries in the world. Second, if you look at sort of more close to Kagan's thesis, what Americans think of the war on terror, there are again quite big differences. High proportion of Americans support the idea of a war on terror, believe that there is a war on terror, and believe that you have to fight it militarily. Much, much lower proportion of Europeans believe this, much lower proportion, believe either that there is something called a war on terror, or that one can fight this war in a way analogous to traditional war in some sense by prosecuting it mainly through the use of military force. Thirdly, just take another element relevant to this, there are fairly big differences these days between Americans and most Europeans on the issue of the United Nations and its role in the world. A large portion of Americans do support the UN, even on the threshold of the Iraq War. The majority of Americans wanted UN sanction for that war to take place. But the proportion of Americans who think that the United Nations is an effective force in the world is much lower than it is in the European countries. So you do find these significant differences, and you have to ask, what is it up to? When I'll be talking about Europe next time, I'll be coming back to all this from a European point of view, but today I'm going to concentrate obviously more on the American one. Now, the fact that now, since 1989, you have this unipolar moment, the United States is easily the dominant world power, has led to really, really interesting discussion on what this power represents. Not only what is the United States internally, what kind of values does it hold, what kind of identity does it have, but what is its position in relation to the wider world? Is it a nation or not? Or is it specifically a new kind of empire? And over the past, well, it's only about 5 years, there's been a proliferation of books on American empire. This proliferation is a bit different from the past because the left always thought that the United States was an imperialist nation. But now you have, I would say, a much more sophisticated set of arguments about American empire from people who are pro as well as people who are against. Some people have written books declaring that the United States is an empire in the post-1989 world, and that this is a good thing for the reason that the United States, as mentioned earlier, is a kind of universal nation. And you might know the book by Neil Ferguson on the issue of American empire. Neil Ferguson also did a television series on the British Empire and wrote a book on the British Empire, so was in a good position, as it were, to decide whether the United States has become a new kind of global empire. His answer is yes, but his answer is that this is basically a progressive thing for the world, precisely because of the values that the United States represents of democracy, secularism, and so forth. Then you have people say, yes, the United States is the head of a new global empire, but it's a terrible thing. And among these, you have Italian leftist, a famous one from the 60s and 70s, called Antonio Negri, who together with another author produced a book simply called Empire. This says, yes, there is a new American empire, and it is a form of control of the rest of the world, of exploitation of the rest of the world, not a, by any means, a beneficent regime for the world. Then finally, you have people who say, well, it's all a sham anyway, that although the United States seems to be in this amazingly powerful position in the world, that actually it's a nation in decline. And it wouldn't surprise you to know these authors are French, mostly, who say this, but, you know, they do it in a sophisticated way. And the most well-known one is a book by a French author called Emmanuel Todd, who says essentially that although the United States seems to be a dominant power in the world, it's in decline because other parts of the world are advancing and the United States is stagnant. So he says the future lies with China, the future lies with India, the future lies with Latin America, because these areas of the world, they're going to be the dynamic areas of the future. America is already overstretched, can't really sustain its position. As we'll see in a minute, there is also a certain element of truth in this, I think. So is the United States an empire? Well, there are three basic considerations which I'd like you to think about in relation to this, and which I'll comment on briefly. Because an empire demands three things, I think. Well, certainly a global empire, if the United States is a global empire, it demands military dominance over the rest of the world in some sense. Second, economic dominance, economic control, most of the rest of the world in some sense or another. And third, cultural dominance. Is it true that the United States is something close to an empire in each of these three dimensions? Well, let's look at military power first, because this is obviously very poignant at the moment and a very, very important topic in its own right. The United States, you can say without any doubt, is the preeminent military power in the world. The United States is the only country in the world, the only area in the world, which is capable of rapidly deploying forces to distant areas. You look at the European Union. The European Union is not able to do this. The European Union does not have transportation for troops to be moved quickly across the world, or any tiny, tiny minority of troops. And the European Union does not have the communication systems which allow this to be done. Electronic communications are essentially controlled by the American military machine, and the European Union does not have a correlate to this. This does give the United States enormous preeminence in military power in the world. And were the Europeans, as I think they should do, develop a more effective security presence in the world, at the moment they cannot do it without the help of the Americans because they don't have the technology to do so. But if you get a bit further into it, you can see that there are reasons to be cautious about what this military preeminence means, what sense it does give the United States coercive power in wider world society. In the first place, the United States has about 1.45 million people under arms, which actually only constitutes about 5% of the total military personnel in the world. China has over 2 million soldiers permanently under arms. The European Union actually has somewhere up to 2 million in its armed forces on a semi-permanent basis. So certainly in terms of soldiery, the United States is in no sense anywhere close to being dominant militarily. And it's become fairly apparent, I think, since Iraq, and the continuing conflict in Iraq, that the United States is not able to prosecute a significant number of wars simultaneously. It's now become, I think, conventional wisdom, actually, in the Pentagon, so I understand it anyway, and certainly among quite a few military experts, that given even with all its military might, the United States can only fight one hot war and one holding war simultaneously, which it is now doing, one hot war in Iraq and one holding operation in Afghanistan. And even if it wanted to, would not be able to mount military operations significantly elsewhere. God, I don't know how I'm going to leave this time for discussion. Anyway, I'll zoom on through the rest of it. Military power also does not make an empire. Military power, you can say, does not an empire make, because Michael Mann, for example, in his book, that's M-A-N-N, called Incoherent Empire, shows that a big difference between, which also Ferguson also accepts, however, a big difference between the position of the United States today and the British Empire in the past. The British never had enough military to actually rule through military power in their domains. They had very few military, for example, in India at any one point. How did they run an empire? Well, they ran an empire through co-opting local elites. They ran an empire because they had local elites who would run the empire for them and who could be persuaded to do so by the power they got. But I think, as Mann points out, you cannot do this today. You cannot run an empire through the connivance of local elites. All you can do is try to influence them. But in a world of much more open knowledge, in a world of much more open dissemination of information, in a world where the idea of sovereignty has gone almost everywhere, you simply can't run an empire in this way. So that when the Americans wanted to use Saudi Arabian airfields to launch the war in Iraq, the Saudis refused to let them do so. So there plainly are limits to the degree to which you can run an empire in the way in which empires were traditionally run. So although America is the dominant military power, one must question how far this military power allows the US to run the world in a coercive way. It doesn't, and I'll come back to that a bit later. As an adjunct to this, I think one should look again at Kagan's thesis about the power and the weakness and ask who is powerful and who is weak. I mean, I had two or three public debates with Kagan when his book was coming out, and my view of what it was and is that all power is dialectical. So there's no such thing as absolute power. Anyone who is weak can turn that weakness back against the strong. This happens in relationships and it happens in international relations too. So what's going on in Iraq today? Does Iraq show the strength of American power or does it show its weakness? Well, I think it shows both. It shows this dialectic. It shows that there are weapons of the weak. Weapons of the weak can involve suicide bombers, can involve kidnapping, can involve various kinds of mechanisms which are extremely hard to defend against if you're trying essentially to run a country from the outside. The weak will always have weapons to turn back against the strong. And I'd ask you to remember what I said last time, that the attack on the World Trade Centers, the World Trade Towers, only involved the use of aeroplanes. Sort of classic case, if you like, of, in a sense, the weak turning against the strong, hitting at the heartlands of the strong. And one should remember that if those planes had actually knocked down the world towers immediately, as they might have done, if they hit at a somewhat different place, 50,000 people would have died rather than between 3,000 to 4,000. So there will always be means of turning power back on the strong. Strength is never an absolute commodity. There's always a dialectic of power, I think, involved in world society. This is also crucial to the limits of high-tech military power in a contemporary world. Moving on to economic power, what does the United States run the world economically? Well, I think you have to say no. The United States is the single most dominant power in the world economically. We all depend on the American economy to drive the overall world economy, as I mentioned in the opening lecture. But the United States does not run the world economy because nobody does. Nobody runs global markets. There are institutions which supervise global markets. Those institutions tend to be linked to American interest, no doubt about it. But the United States is not in a position to run the world economy. It's only in a position to influence the world economy because nobody runs a global market economy. Moreover, when you go back to the Immanuel Todd thesis, there are reasons to suppose that American economic power is more fraught than one might think at first sight. Again, for reasons I briefly mentioned in the first lecture. There's an interesting book on this issue, if anyone is concerned with it. Won't work this bloody thing again. Which is by a guy called Gerald Swanson. And this book is called America the Broke. And it discusses the role of debt in the American economy. And Swanson points out that no previous American president has fought a war while reducing taxes. It's never happened before. This American administration has fought two wars while having two tax reductions. And Swanson says the result is absolutely gigantic debt within the American economy, which he says is much greater than is calculated in the ordinary statistics. He says the current level of debt in the American economy is $7.3 trillion, which is equivalent to about $25,000 for every person in the United States. And he says, this is an interesting point, I think, that if interest rates rose again, as they might do, because no one knows what will happen, economic change. If interest rates rose to 18%, America would be totally broke. It would not have a single cent to spend on defense, on social security programs, on anything. And he calls this fiscal Armageddon. The United States is flirting with fiscal Armageddon. But whether that's true or not, it certainly does indicate that there are limits to the degree to which America is a kind of economic superpower. It does have structural problems quite deeply at its core, although I don't think they'll lead to the kind of Armageddon that he talks about. What about American cultural power, briefly? A Starbucks on every corner, all that kind of stuff. American movies all across the world. Is the United States a dominant cultural force? Well, it certainly is in the entertainment industries. High portion of movies produced in the world are American. You see McDonald's all over the world. But I think, again, it's a mistake to see this as simple cultural dominance. Because all over the world you see reactions to these symbols and to what they mean. In Europe, as you know, we famously have a slow food movement. Slow food movement is contesting American fast food. In India, they produce as many movies as Hollywood does. All over the world, you see a kind of revival of local identity, a revival of local culture, a revival of local ideas and local languages. There is no simple American cultural dominance. It's a veneer of cultural dominance, I think, rather than a genuine one. So where did this leave us with American empire? Well, I think it leaves us with this conclusion. The United States has an ambiguous identity, just like the European Union does, but for different reasons, as I mentioned next time. It is no longer simply a nation because it has global spread, but it is not a traditional empire either it is not an analogue to the British Empire. I think one of the best ways of describing it really is as a quasi-empire, and Michael Mann calls it an incoherent empire, and I think perhaps that's the best way to describe it. It has global spread, but its purchase on world society is much less. It's much more fragmented. It's much less powerful than one might imagine at first sight. What about American cultural identity? What about what's happening in America? What about the differences between the United States and Europe? Here again, you have a really interesting discussion in the recent literature. Some people argue that the United States is shifting radically towards the right. If you forgive me, I won't carry on writing all these names on here because it just takes up too much time and not very good writing anyway, but a journalist from the Financial Times called John Micklethwaite, together with a guy called Adrian Wool, has just produced a book called The Right Nation. In The Right Nation, the authors argue that the United States is diverging quite sharply from Europe, just as Kagan says. It's becoming a different nation from the past. It's becoming dominated by the right. The right is setting the agenda, and this is pushing the United States into a new global role, too. They say if you go back to the 1960s, it seemed at that point as though there was a convergence between the United States and Europe. In the 1960s, you had the Great Society Program. You had the war on poverty. You had an expanding welfare state in America. You had a kind of commitment to further expansion of anti-poverty programs. You had abolition of the death penalty. All these things, they say, have now changed. The United States is in the grip of the right, the political right, and this reflects kind of structural change in the society at large. And they've got quite interesting statistics on this. They point out that if you look for a single predictor of whether a white American will vote Republican in the United States, the single most important predictor is whether that person goes to church regularly. And since a high proportion do go to church regularly, this is a kind of expression of the capture of America by the political right. He says in the United States there are 200 Christian TV channels, 1,500 Christian radio stations, and of course a highly organized Christian right, and of course one should also say that at the moment anyway, might change, Republicans dominate both houses in the Congress in the United States. And he sees this as some sort of structural shift. The United States will veer away from Europe and maybe to some extent from the rest of the world community. Is this view correct? No, I don't think so. I don't think it is. I mean, with time will of course tell, but I think it's much more correct to make the following set of observations, which are basically that the United States and Europe share much more in common than the divergences they have. The United States is much closer to being a 50-50 nation than it is to a nation dominated simply by a particular position or particular political spectrum. If you look at the differences in religion, first of all, these differences certainly exist between the United States and Europe. But you have to remember that religion has a different function in American society. There's an important thing in America which is called by sociologists in-church secularization. People do believe in God, yes, but they go to church because of social reasons quite often, not just because of direct and passionate religious commitment. The difference in church going is not as great as looks at first sight between, big as it is, and it is significant, between the United States and Europe. Second, I think it's true to say there is not a single model of capitalism in Europe. So those who say you have aggressive American capitalism linked to the dominance of the right think this is not correct. There are a lot of differences within the United States in terms of the different states of the US. Some states have a position much closer to some European countries in terms of having high welfare provision and so forth. California was one of those, at least until relatively recently in some respects, and quite a range of states have had a very different kind of orientation towards social provision from the federal government when it has been captured by the Republican right. In Europe, you have very big differences in styles of capitalism. Some countries are much closer to what is usually thought of as US capitalism than others. For example, Ireland, which is the fastest growing country in Europe, looks quite a lot like the United States in terms of its economic system. There is not a simple comparison of this kind between the two. Finally, and when you go back to the Kagan thesis, it's been true, at least in the past, before 9/11, that some European states were more willing to fight militarily overseas than the United States was. And these countries include Britain and France. Britain and France, in the past, have had a more aggressive overseas posture than the United States used to have in the post-war period, because for a long period there was this fear of body bags in America and fear of loss of American life in war. And during that period, some of the European countries were more from Mars than the United States was more from Venus. There are not these simple comparisons. And if I were to characterize the United States, I wouldn't say really 50-50 society, I'd say 30-30 society. 30% cosmopolitan looking outwards, 30% rightist, dominated by religious right, the rest relatively uncommitted and willing to be altered by circumstances, certainly in terms of their votes in the election that we'll see in a few days' time. So how should one conclude from all this? Well, I'd like, rather than stopping for a discussion, I'd like just very briefly, if you don't mind, to say what my conclusions are, what America's role should be, what it ideally anyway should be. First of all, I'm very much in sympathy with the view that the United States has prospered most when it's been a multilateral nation. And that, you know, the United States helped to build the international institutions, which are now so important on the global scene. The United States helped to build virtually all of the institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations itself in the post-war period. And in that, when it's engaged multilaterally with the rest of the world, it also tends to help American interests too. There's not necessarily a conflict of interest there. Second, one has to say, however, that there will be times when preemptive action is necessary in the world where the United Nations will not agree. And some of the main difficulties for us concern the circumstances under which that preemptive action is taken. Most people now agree it should have been taken in Rwanda, even though the United Nations could not agree. It was taken in Kosovo without the support of the United Nations Security Council. There will be circumstances in which this is necessary, and it will always be difficult to say both what the role of the United States and the wider world community should be, but my view is they should always have at least a large coalition of democratic nations if you're going to undertake such action. Thirdly, this intervention will sometimes have to be preemptive before the event. Not only a matter for the Bush administration, it's a matter for world society. But why can't the Bush administration see that preemptive action has to be of many different kinds? Why no preemptive action against environmental change? Why no preemptive action against money laundering across the world? Why no preemptive action against a range of problems which we face in the world? Preemptive action will often be necessary. It won't always have United Nations sanction, but it can't simply be defined purely in military terms. Finally, then, I think, you know, one has to conclude that there are two types of free riding in the world when you compare the United States and Europe, both of which we have to seek to overcome, which I'll discuss in the next lecture. First of all, there is the free riding of Europe on the United States. The Europeans, I think Kagan is partly right, the Europeans created a kind of world of perpetual peace for themselves, but they depend upon the United States, for better or for worse, to police much of the rest of the world. The Europeans will not, at the moment, give much money towards taxpayers, won't give much money to creating a much larger rapid reaction force, which Europe surely needs if it's going to assert itself on the world stage. Europe, to some extent, is free riding of American power and hypocritical to some degree in its relation to that power. On the other hand, the United States is free riding, because the United States is free riding on all the global agreements on which a reasonably stable world depends, but which the United States at the moment refuses to sign up to. Not just the Kyoto Treaty, but a whole range of international obligations, without which you couldn't have American prosperity, without which you couldn't have a consistent world society. We have to overcome both of these, I think, if we're going to produce a world which is better run, which is more secure, and which will help the disadvantaged. Apologies about not finishing in time, but maybe next time if you come, we're trying to have a discussion at some point in the lecture. So thanks again for coming today.